Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm joined today by Stephen Zunis. He's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco and the coordinator of the program in Middle Eastern studies there. He's also a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy and Focus Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and a contributing editor at Tikkun magazine. Professor Zunis, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
In your work, you argue that in the waves of democratization we've seen across the world in the last 30 years, nonviolent activist opposition has played the most important role. I want to explore that a little bit. First, just how striking has the last 30 years been for worldwide democratization? It's certainly not always obvious that progress is being made.
Well, certainly, it's been uneven. And as this wave of democratization has taken place, some authoritarian regimes are getting more effective at challenging it. And of course, there have been a number of reversals. But overall, since I was an undergraduate back in the 1970s, we've seen more than 70 countries move from dictatorship to some degree of democracy. What we found is that some, of course, regimes fell through armed revolution, a few more through voluntary reforms by elite, kind of top-down guided liberalization.
Within the system.
Within the system, yes, and only one or two through foreign intervention. But the vast majority of cases, close to three-quarters of those transitions, the most important single variable was democratic civil society organizations engaged in strategic nonviolent action.
And I wanted to ask you about precisely what you mean by nonviolent activist opposition. So explain that a bit more beyond just the phrase itself to me.
Well, certainly it includes, public demonstrations and popular contestation of public space. But it can also mean things like boycotts, strikes, burning of symbols of government authority like ID cards, violation of public regime orders like curfew restrictions. It can also include the establishment of parallel and alternative institutions for social organization and legitimacy. It is the kind of thing that, unlike armed struggle, which is usually centered on able-bodied men with guns, it's the kind of thing that the entire society, regardless of age or gender or physical ability, can take part in.
And over the course of the 30 years, what countries and regimes would you say fall into like the greatest hits category?
Well, certainly we can start with the Philippines and the downfall of the U.S.-backed Marcos dictatorship and the people power movement there. We saw in Latin America and forcing Pinochet to have a referendum, which the dictator of Chile, who lost, and as well as Bolivia and some other Latin American countries. Eastern Europe, of course. It wasn't NATO that brought down communism. It was Polish dock workers, East German church people, Czech intellectuals, Estonian folk singers, and millions of other ordinary Eastern Europeans that faced down the tanks with their bare hands. Some of the post-communist dictatorships, most notably Milosevic in Serbia. It wasn't 11 weeks of NATO bombing that got rid of the butcher of the Balkans, but young Serbian students who mobilized the population after a stolen election. And we're starting, but we also see it in parts of Africa, and not just North Africa, where Tunisia has been the most prominent success story of the recent Arab Spring, but in countries like Benin and Madagascar. And in fact, South Africa, the armed wing of the ANC never got beyond an occasional acts of sabotage. It was the United Democratic Front, COSATU, the trade union movement. It was the mass resistance in the townships that ultimately made the apartheid system unsustainable and forced them to negotiate with Mandela and lead to majority rule.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with University of San Francisco professor Stephen Zunis, an expert on nonviolent opposition movements that are pushing for democracy. Okay, so you've given me these many examples. Why exactly do you think the nonviolent opposition is more effective than the alternative approaches? And the other piece of this is, in many of the cases you gave me, there were violent and armed oppositions or outside interventions, and you're separating out sort of the nonviolent aspect as being the real cause for the change. Could you talk a little bit about both of those things?
Well, sure. No struggle is completely nonviolent or completely violent. They're all mixed. But I emphasize the ones on where at which the primary mode of struggle, the most significant mode of struggle politically, but also the one that involved the largest amount of participants, were those who rejected the use of violence. Now, I should emphasize this is not out of ethical considerations. In many ways, Gandhi and King were exceptions to the rule in that they were both religious pacifists and leaders of strategic nonviolent action. The vast majority of people and leaders of these movements chose nonviolence not because they were pacifists, not because they had any kind of religious or ethical commitment to nonviolence per se, but they saw it as the most effective means of struggle. This was, in other words, it was a strategic decision, not a moral decision. Another reason is that for effective regime change from below, you need defectors from within the system. And for example, soldiers and police are much less likely to defect if they're being shot at than if they're being ordered to fire into a crowd of unarmed demonstrators who could be their friends, neighbors, family members. Another factor is that the large undecided population, which you find in almost all these struggles, people who may not necessarily like the regime but are scared of change and maybe reluctant to support the opposition. If the opposition is taking up arms, even for a just cause, it makes people nervous. They're concerned about the people who are involved who might end up taking over. And indeed are less sympathetic because they might believe the regime's propaganda, oh, we're just fighting terrorism and we're trying to maintain order.
Now, let's take the other side of the coin. Are there particularly successful instances in the last few years where either working through the system from within or having some kind of armed violent resistance has actually been an effective path for a democratic transition?
We've certainly seen quite a number of cases of armed struggles which have brought down dictatorships, but often it's at a very huge cost. And more often than not, it ends up with another dictatorship. In 90% of the cases when dictatorships are overthrown by armed struggles, they become new dictatorships and or collapse into a bloody civil war or factional fighting because armed movements by their nature are based on this kind of secret elite vanguard, this hierarchy of command and control, martial values. And that leadership style by the guerrilla commanders, they hold on to that more often than not when they come to power. Whereas in nonviolent struggles, because to build that big majority base, you have to build broad coalitions with movements and organizations and people who may not necessarily agree with you with what the post-regime economic policies or foreign policies might be, but you're united in your opposition to the dictatorship. So you have to do give and take. It forms a pluralistic model that can then carry on to the post-dictatorial period. So that's why, in contrast to armed struggles, when nonviolent movements overthrow dictatorships, the majority of them end up within 3 to 5 years being stable democracies. There are exceptions, but by and large, it is a much more likely means to create a democratic order after the downfall of the old regime.
I want to take this back further in history to the American Revolution, which I guess is an outlier in all of this. Have things changed over the years in the sense of how successful something like the American Revolution could be?
Well, a lot of people forget that a lot of the American Revolution was nonviolent. Oh. We tend to glorify, of course, the revolutionary soldiers. But if you actually look at the records of the time, including the correspondence of the British governors and the like, it was the tax strikes, the massive non-cooperation that was at least as problematic as the soldiers. Indeed, if the French hadn't intervened, we would have almost certainly lost the war, but it was a nonviolent resistance. It actually started in the 1760s that really helped undermine British control. I think the Boston Tea Party may be the only incident that really made it to our history books, but that was just one of quite a number of incidents of civil resistance within the colonies.
And I'm talking with Stephen Zunis. He's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco and an expert on democratization and opposition movements. I wanted to further explore the nature of these nonviolent protest movements that we've been discussing. It's one thing to say that they are nonviolent and in opposition to authoritarian regimes. It's another thing to say that the movements themselves are democratic. How democratic are these movements as movements?
Well, they vary, and a lot of it depends on the strength of civil society prior to the launching of the movement, and it depends a lot on the nature of the leadership, and so it varies considerably. As I mentioned earlier, I think the in order to build the broad coalitions to be successful, you end up with a pretty diverse kind of leadership, diverse organizations. You don't tend to you're much less likely to have a clear single leader. And unfortunately, in some cases where that was the case, such as in Iran, where it was a largely nonviolent uprising against the Shah, the Ayatollahs ended up taking over, and they imposed a new authoritarian system. But and sometimes nonviolent movements will be victorious so quickly, they don't really have time to consolidate these kinds of institutions. In fact, successful nonviolent movements, on average, take one quarter of the time of victorious armed movements to succeed. And I think one thing we found in Egypt was that while there had been certain antecedents to the struggle going on for years, the revolution itself only lasted 18 days, and the military was able to effectively seize control. And when they had the elections, the more democratic secular opposition was divided, so that the top two vote getters ended up being their total down vote was the majority. The two top vote getters ended up being the military candidate and the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, the worst possible choices in the minds of the pro-democracy activist. And more problematically, the pro-democracy activists did not have the experience, organization, or money that the Muslim Brotherhood and the military had. So that was to their disadvantage. It can sometimes be a challenge, if you don't have good political organization. You don't just need good tactics. You also need good leadership. You need good vision. You need good organization.
So it sounds like then there's a relationship between how effective these movements are in the end in terms of what ultimately results and how democratically they're organized and also how organized they are and how they're led. So it sounds like there needs to be leadership and structure, but it also needs to be democratic and not just one person.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, just like any other kind of movement, you need to think strategically, not just in terms of how to overcome the other side, but how you build your organization.
I wonder if there's any application of your arguments to the United States itself. A recent thorough study of U.S. policymaking by a couple of researchers at Princeton University concluded, for example, that we are now an oligarchy, not a democracy. Is there any application of your research to thinking about the American situation?
Well, if you look at the struggles that have made our country more democratic over the years, it's almost always been through popular nonviolent struggles, from the women's suffrage movement to the civil rights movement to the American labor movement. Almost all the progress that we've seen in making our country more democratic has come through popular nonviolent struggles. And I think there's a I would agree that there is a particular need now, with the increasing concentration of power in the hands of the wealthy. What we saw through the Occupy movement, the beginnings of that kind of resistance, though the lack of organization and other strategic errors made that short-lived. I think it is just an indication of what we may be seeing more of in the future, hopefully in a more organized and strategic way.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is University of San Francisco professor Stephen Zunis. In the time we have left, I want to turn to a specific area of the world that you have focused on, the Middle East, and even more specifically, Israel and Palestine. How likely is it that we'll see lasting peace and cooperation there, say, in the next 20 years?
Well, I think most people on both sides recognize that the other is there to stay, in a sense that the Palestinians, despite what they perceive as great injustices done to them and the and Zionist movement and expulsion and occupation and the like, realize that Israeli Jews are now part of the Middle East and they have to live with them. And similarly, the Israelis recognize that, well, they've not yet recognized the Palestinians as a state, and they're not yet willing to provide them with the amount of territory to make a viable state. At least there's some acknowledgement that they're a nation. They do have a right of self-determination, and so I think that what's important is to. Is that both sides, find nonviolent ways of resolving the conflict. Now, the problem is that though I personally believe that both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs have equal rights to self-determination and peace and security, the fact is that the Israelis have the upper hand right now. They're the occupier, and international law, the onus of compromise does belong with the occupation. And given that the Palestine Authority, under the leadership of President Abbas and the PLO, has finally come around to the idea of accepting Israel and accepting Israel on the 72% of Palestine in the pre-67 borders, and they're welcome open to minor and reciprocal border adjustments, and security guarantees, a demilitarized state. The Israelis are the ones at this point who do need to be willing to allow them that. Unfortunately, the United States has a contradictory role as both the chief mediator of the conflict and the chief military, diplomatic, and financial supporter of the more powerful of the two parties. And that has made it difficult to, I think, to move the process forward, indeed allowing Israel to get away with expanding its illegal settlements, which have more than doubled since the signing of the Oslo Treaty and has made it the establishment of a viable Palestinian state in the West Bank less and less powerful. So I think the best hope for peace would be the United States to engage in kind of tough love towards Israel, that is unconditional, continue our unconditional support for Israel's right to exist in peace and security, but to be able to put pressure on the current right-wing government to make the necessary compromises for peace.
You touched on a couple things I wanted to ask you about. One is this issue of the United States as the principal intermediary. If I put myself in the shoes of a Palestinian citizen, it is hard for me to imagine taking the United States seriously as an intermediary because, as you point out, its starting position is one of supporting Israel. So how can the U.S. have any kind of moral authority in this process over there?
It is certainly based on our behavior thus far. It does make it difficult. I think the best way to look at it is if we really support Israel. And again, I don't have nothing against supporting Israel per se. We need to think, what is in Israel's actual interest? Because as many Israelis will tell you, Israel will be far more secure within its internationally recognized border and at peace with its neighbors. And remember, not just the PLO, the Palestine Authority, but the neighboring Arab states have expressed a willingness to have full diplomatic relations, security guarantees in return for withdrawal. They'd be far more secure that than this archipelago of illegal settlements and isolated military outposts amidst a hostile population. And more Israeli soldiers are outside of Israel engaging in a repressive occupation than they are inside the country defending it. And whenever I hear people say, we can't pressure Israel because Israel's our friend, my response is, what do you do when your friend is drunk at the bar with the car keys in their hand? They're stumbling out towards their vehicle. A friend says, hey, I'm not going to let you hurt yourself or other people and take the keys away. And some of my Israeli friends say that's a good analogy, except they'd extend it further. The United States is the bartender. We're the enabler. We're pouring the stuff, by our continued military and economic aid, our vetoing UN Security Council resolutions, and other things that give Israel no incentive to compromise.
So if you could change one thing, let's boil it down. If you could change one thing about American foreign policy in this area, what would it be? Would it be a change in the rhetoric toward tough love, or can you think of some things that are more specific you'd change?
Well, I think that my change in terms of Israel-Palestine is what I'd like to see change in U.S. policy overall. It's one that's that where we live up to our own rhetoric around human rights and international law. I mean, I have real problems with people who unfairly single out Israel for criticism. But I also have problems with people who unfairly, believe Israel should get away with things that no other country should get away with. I mean, how can we in credibility, put sanctions and other pressure on Russia for their illegal annexation of Crimea when Israel's already illegally annexed part of the occupied territories and is calling for the annexation of more of it, not to mention Morocco and its annexation of Western Sahara. That's another ally that's engaged in occupation we don't hear about as much, but the same kind of principle is involved. So I think we really need to the bottom line is we need to live up to our rhetoric of supporting democracy, self-determination, and rule of law, which is, after all, are the principles on which our nation was founded.
So the response that you always get when you put forward an argument like that, well, is it depends on the strategic interests of the country in different parts of the world. So that changes depending on what part of the world you're looking at, and therefore our response needs to change.
Not necessarily, because I would say that support for Arab dictatorships and occupation armies has actually hurt our strategic interest. I mean, I don't think we would have seen al-Qaeda arise the way it has if the United States was not supporting the Saudi regime, was not supporting the Israeli occupation, was not supporting the dictatorships and Egypt and the Emirates and other parts of the world. I mean, I find that when we get in trouble, when there's anti-American extremism in various parts of the world, it's not because of our values, but it's when we stray from our values.
Let me get to the three questions. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I'd say enjoying the plateau. Like a lot of people, I struggled early in my career and in other things, but I'm just really enjoying where I am right now in terms of my life, in terms of my marriage, in terms of my family, in terms of where I live. I think things are going well.
Second, what's your worst trait?
I take on too much, and as a result, I'm not getting enough sleep, and there are always some people upset at me because I'm late on a deadline or not following through on something.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
I think I'm surprised actually at my success as a writer and researcher. When I entered academia, I thought I would be best known as a good teacher, and I am a pretty decent teacher. I'm pretty popular, but I was always worried I might not get tenure because I wasn't publishing the right journals or that kind of thing. But much to my surprise, I'm also in demand as a writer and researcher, and that part of my career has gone well as well.
That was Stephen Zunis. Stephen, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure. Really enjoyed this.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Research assistance was provided by Brooke Weinstein. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. Visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations for more information.